Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Happy Thursday, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Excellent episode for you today. I spoke with Peter Goodman, who is the New York Times' global economics correspondent, about his book, Davos Man, How Billionaires Devoured the World. One of my favorite things that I can do as an interviewer is speak to guests towards the end of their book tour. Peter appeared on Breaking Points. He was on Crystal Cowan Friends. So it was great to get him towards the end and really push around the ideas around his claims around the past half century of wealth creation, how billionaires, institutions like Wall Street, tech companies, specific people have either worked or conspired to cause all of the troubles that have really affected all of us the past few years leading up into COVID. Lots of great stuff here. Super curious how everyone feels. So without ado, we'll get into the episode. Quick show notes before we start. One, if you enjoy this episode, enjoy my questions, send a tip. It's in the show notes. Two, it's Thursday, so the Substack's coming out. Three, this is a book. There is a bookshop. If you purchase a book at the bookshop link, you will help the show get 10% of the sale and you'll help support a local independent bookseller. Finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work, though I'm not sure we'll be soliciting any billionaires after we host this episode. Let's get into it. See you guys next time. Peter Goodman, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed Davos Man because you're telling anecdotes, there are stories, but it's also tied to a deeper idea. But one of the parts that really made me laugh as someone who conducts lots of conversations is this part of the book where you're speaking, I think, with Mark Benioff, and he says something on the lines of, we need to have a conversation. And you're basically to the reader, wait, I thought, what have we been doing the past forever? So for this episode, I see us as having the opportunity to have the conversation. So let's have that.
A multi-stakeholder dialogue. Yeah. Yeah. Benioff was speaking at the forum. I think that was back in 2017. And he was on, you know, one of the many very earnest seminars that fills out the World Economic Forum in Davos. I think this one was about automation and threat to jobs. And yeah, he was asked, I mean, this is a guy who is the CEO of Salesforce, this large Silicon Valley company that's making its money automating all sorts of jobs that used to be fulfilled by human beings that are now taken over by bots and algorithms. And he said, yes, you know, it's really an important question. We need to have a multi-stakeholder dialogue about this.
Can you speak to, we'll get into what Davos and the broader organization that runs it actually are, but can you speak about Davos language? Because this is also something that comes through throughout the book, and it comes through if you're looking at various people who speak to this type of audience. You use the word collaborator, which is very funny. I'd like to get into the collaborators lately, but this fourth industrial revolution, humanity first capitalism. Yes, I'm referring to Andrew Yang. He's been on the show. I like Andrew, but Andrew very much speaks in Davos speak. Can you just speak about this style of language? It's kind of centristy. It Sure. seems serious, but it doesn't really mean that much when you actually get into it. Let's talk about that part of the conversation first.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think central to understanding how Davos Man, the species that I'm writing about, the ultimate billionaire class that writes the rules for the rest of us, the way in which they convince large numbers of people that they can be entrusted to solve the world's problems without being bothered by things like progressive taxation, regulation, antitrust enforcement, is they've kind of corporatized the language of doing good. So, you know, the classic sort of win-win solution, that's kind of like Davos Man baby speak, right? This is a way of like, why should anyone sacrifice? We'll find a win-win solution. And therefore, the people who already have most of the wealth can keep all of it and will indulge in this fantasy of trickle down. So that, you know, that's one of them. Stakeholder is a huge word for Davos, man. And this concept of stakeholder capitalism, which was really pioneered by Klaus Schwab, who's the founder of the World Economic Forum. He's been talking about stakeholder capitalism since the 1970s. It started off as this sort of innocent way of describing public-private partnerships, the kind of, you know, easily defended notion that government and the private sector ought to work together to talk about solutions to various problems. But it's come to mean Milton Friedmanism is dead. Corporations are no longer organized just to return profit. Now they're accountable to their stakeholders. And that's labor, never labor unions, mind you, but always labor, local communities, though not anything formal. Like, it's always got to be unilateral and on the billionaire class's own terms. Social issues, you know, Davos, man, is big into ESG, the environment, social issues. And stakeholder is this term that kind of just glorifies whatever non-Davos man interest must be dealt with in the pursuit of whatever Davos man is up to, usually some kind of merger, tax cuts, deregulation. And by putting it in terms of the stakeholder, there's this nod at, you know, we're looking out for everybody here so you can trust us.
Here's a question. You just referenced Milton Friedman. I'd love for you to sum up for the audience what Milton Friedman's idea in this category, basically, what is stakeholder capitalism responding to when it comes to a specific version of Milton Friedman's arguments? And here's what I'm curious about, which is ultimately more destructive to the public space you're describing? Milton Friedman honesty, whether you like the ideas or not, or the very laundered Davos man ideology and point of view?
That's a fantastic question. I have not been asked this question. So first of all, Milton Friedman, of course, is the godfather of neoliberalism. This idea that if we just get the government out of the way, we let the magic of the markets dominated by the private sector, not hassled by bureaucrats, you know, that will maximize wealth for everyone. And this idea has seized the levers of policy, certainly in the US, going back to Reagan in the 80s, Britain under Thatcher, and really much of the wealthy world. We've been living in the era of Milton Friedmanism, and it was really an idea that was central to the concept that if companies just behaved greedily, if they pursued their own interests, then everybody's interests would benefit from this. And so stakeholder capitalism is a recognition that a lot of us have gotten fed up with this idea that corporations should have all the power and CEOs should write the rules for the rest of us. And stakeholder capitalism specifically says, hey, trust us. We're going to be forces for good now. We're not just going to think about immediate profits. So we're going to worry about not getting caught with sweatshops in Bangladesh. We're not going to exploit our workers in America or Britain or wherever. We're going to think about the totality of society holistically. Now, you ask which of these ideas is more dangerous, and that's a really interesting one that we should chew on. I conclude in the book that stakeholder capitalism is uniquely dangerous because with Milton Friedmanism, to your point, you know, we know what we're getting, right? Most of us, I think, are not under the impression that we can outsource the solution of climate change or racial and gender inequality or lack of affordable housing or lack of affordable medicine to a bunch of billionaires who've already rigged society to send more wealth in their favor. So Milton Friedmanism is just a recognition that it's like that's the world we live in. Stakeholder capitalism is an elaborate means of trying to deceive us that we can trust the billionaires. We need not react the way American democracy reacted to the robber barons in the 1920s with antitrust enforcement, with progressive taxation to finance social safety programs. We can double down on Milton Friedmanism, but under this new guise of trusting the billionaires. That's where I come up with this taxonomy of Davos man. I tell you in the book that Davos man is really a predator, but he preys on us by taking the stance of our friend, and he uses that to gain our trust and rip our face off.
So let's set the table. Just define, what is Davos? Like, actually, like, literally, what is it? What's the World Economic Forum, the organization that puts on the Davos conference? And let's just give that construct. Then we'll get into the different taxonomies of Davos man.
So Davos is this unusually charmless village high up in the Swiss Alps. It's far from everywhere. For a while, it was a sanitarium for people suffering from tuberculosis. And back in the early 1970s, Klaus Schwab, who is a German economist who speaks in this almost absurdly thick German accent, goes off to the U.S. He gets steeped in management theories, and he decides, I'm going to start a conference. I'm going to gather businesses and government officials, and we're going to meet on top of the mountain far beyond the reach of outside distractions, and we're going to sort of meditate on the world's biggest problems. Well, from that idea, the World Economic Forum is born. And the World Economic Forum has grown into this enormous event. It draws like 3,000 people, draws many of the billionaires who most people have heard of. It draws heads of state. I mean, Xi Jinping has been there. Donald Trump's been there twice. Bill Clinton used to go all the time. Tony Blair's been. And they meet. There are now celebrities. I once had dinner with Peter Gabriel, who told me about how he was making music with chimpanzees. I mean, there's always artists and poets, but there's this forward-facing forum, which was Klaus Schwab's kind of entrepreneurial genius, right? Like he recognized that Forbes and Fortune, Bloomberg, they could throw these sort of run-of-the-mill conferences where business people could get together and figure out how to make more money. His genius was to say, no. This is about improving the state of the world. The mantra of the forum is committed to improving the state of the world, which is a stunning statement considering that it's a gathering of the ultimate beneficiaries of the status quo. But it actually has gotten businesses to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for memberships. They pay tens of thousands of dollars to attend the forum itself in Davos every January. And, you know, they all do it under this idea that we're not just here to make money. We're actually signaling our virtues. And this has been such a successful proposition that now people go basically just to schmooze and make deals. So in the Congress Center, this big conference center in the center of the village, there are these seminars on, you know, corporate governance 2.0, various versions of the Green New Deal, solutions to eradicate poverty. And the cool kids, the billionaires who are actually paying the bills for all this, they will tell you in this kind of beleaguered, you know, sophisticated, nod, nod, wink, wink way. They don't even set foot in the conference center. Or maybe they will occasionally. Like I've gone to see them engage in the simulation of the Syrian refugee experience. They'll show up for that, right? They'll submit to being blindfolded, led around in the dark while someone's hollering at them in some language they don't understand, demanding papers. They'll all congratulate one another for their display of empathy. And then they'll go off to the Belvenir Hotel, this big colossus beyond the Congress Center, and they'll go to a dinner where they have truffles and drink champagne and eat caviar underwritten by like HSBC or Citibank or some global bank. That's the real thing. The other time they come into the Congress Center is for these secret matchmaker sessions that Schwab has pioneered. They'll pay for access to these executive lounges where only the other people who've paid extravagant sums for such access will be. And this is a place where, you know, Schwab can just gleefully match up a member of the Saudi monarchy with the CEO of a European or American fossil fuel company that's looking for a new concession. He'll twin a global consulting firm with an authoritarian leader from the developing world, you know, looking to boost contracts. And there's no annoying journalists there. There are no regulators. This is where, as one former forum official put it to me, the most powerful people go to write the rules in secret for the rest of us.
So many things come from that, but let's just start with this obvious, semi-joking, but semi-serious question. Is Davos man just a politically correct version of the word globalist? What's the difference between these two? Because there is an actual difference, but what would you say the difference is?
Well, I mean, Davos men is a term that was coined by Samuel Huntington in 2004, a political scientist. And he was essentially describing people who go to Davos, people who don't have any allegiance to any particular country or jurisdiction because their wealth is so complicated that it flows across borders. They've got accountants and lobbyists in multiple countries. So he was essentially describing globalists. I'm using it in some ways more expansively because I don't think you necessarily have to be a billionaire to be a Davos man, but in some ways more narrowly. I'm especially interested in the wealthy people who are specifically telling us that they are the solution to our problems. They are using Davos itself as this charade to signal their virtues and to hang out with other like-minded people so they can strengthen one another in the certainty of their goodness, which then allows them to internalize this idea that, you know, well, if we're the good guys and we're the smartest, which is how we ended up with all the money, then we ought to have more money because the more money we've got, the more good we can do. And therefore, we shouldn't waste our money giving it to those, you know, feckless bureaucrats in Washington or Brussels or wherever. We should keep it and then use it through philanthropic enterprises, through all the brilliant ideas we're going to come up with that will be innovations. And, you know, the archetype, Mark Benioff, CEO of Salesforce, who last year at Davos literally says, CEOs are the real heroes of the pandemic. Not, you know, he's not talking about frontline medical workers. He's not talking about essential workers who are delivering our packages and our food and working in warehouses, not parents dealing with kids stuck at home, contending with distance learning. He's talking about the CEOs. And he underscores this. You know, he says, this is, they gave us vaccines, they gave us credit, which staved off bankruptcy. He specifically says, government did not save you. We saved you, not for profit, but to save the world. And I've heard some people say, well, that's the sort of bombast that amounts to a gaffe. That's not a gaffe. I mean, that's a worldview. That essentially is a justification for the fact that Benioff's company has twice, on revenues of several billion dollars, paid the modest sum of zero in federal taxes. And this is a justification for that that we may laugh at when we actually read the quote. It may seem so ridiculous that we can pass it off. But the central idea that the billionaires have earned their wealth, they're the good guys, and we shouldn't monkey with a system in which they are at the center. That idea has really captured central force in our political discourse.
Here's a question for you. Is Elon Musk a Davos man? Because he has parts of the ideology you're describing, but he, A, wouldn't buy Time magazine like Mark Benioff did.
Right.
He isn't interested. He talks to Kara Swisher, so he cares about respectability to a certain degree. But he doesn't have, I would say, the maximized establishment-y aspect that many of the people you're describing. Where does Elon Musk fit into this?
He's an interesting case because I mean, I think his brand is like he really doesn't care what we think of him. So that in some ways that makes him not a Davos man. He doesn't really want our adulation. He just wants power itself. But he justifies the extreme actions that he takes and his abrasive manner and his candor by essentially saying, look, I am saving the world, right? I mean, I'm a major solution to climate change, so you're stuck with me. And in some ways that may, so I'd call him kind of a hybrid Davos man.
So here's the problem though, to a certain degree, at least at a high level macro scale, it seems like he's kind of accurate when he says that, right? So let's talk about this part of it, which is, it'd be one thing if we're having this Davos man, Milton Friedman, Ubermenschian, you know, Ayn Randian, you know, corporate superhero saving the world conversation in the 40s and 50s and the 60s, where you have a specific, not only set of leaders, but a specific conception of the US government that was much more active. But today you have a government which is inactive in a variety of different levels. You have a crop of politicians that I think most people can agree is not as credible. A Congress that has Marjorie Taylor Greene in it is not a Congress that could be compared to previous Congresses. So the Green New Deal isn't going to pass. So it kind of seems like all we do have is Davos. And it seems like all we do actually have are the people you're describing here. So what do you think about that difficult part of the dynamic?
Well, first of all, you know, I don't demonize these guys. I mean, that may seem ironic given some of the things that I'm saying about them. I mean, there's a lot of hypocrisy. There's a lot of, you know, titillating sort of rich guy porn to wade through that's kind of absurd and sometimes grotesque. But I'm not saying we don't need Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Mark Benioff for that matter. I mean, these guys are skilled. They're good at things like software, engineering. They've dreamed up a lot of products and systems that are extremely useful. I'm a capitalist. I mean, I think the markets are the best way for us to realize the prices of things. I think markets are great at allocating capital to the most efficient use and all that. The market system has, you know, cured diseases. It's cured boredom. It's solved transportation problems that people suffered, you know, for millennia. So I'm a markets guy. I just think it's ridiculous for us to think that we can outsource all of our problems to Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Mark Benioff. I think we got to have rules, and markets don't actually work unless there's a regulator to ensure that no games are being played. I mean, markets will always tend toward monopoly if you just leave them unregulated. And so then we don't get the magic of price transparency. What we've actually got is not free markets. We've got a kind of welfare capitalism for the richest people on earth who can afford to hire lobbyists. And we've got rugged individualism for everyone else. And, you know, we can get to this later, but I mean, the permutations of that, just for how you have a conversation, how you run a democracy, are dark and troubling. But I, you know, back to your question about Musk, I mean, I think that a company like Tesla could absolutely be a part of the solution. It may well be part of the solution to climate change. I just think we have to tax companies so that the people who are making a fortune off of their ideas, and they ought to make a fortune. Like, you know, look, I have no problem with Bezos being one of the richest people on earth. I have a problem with Jeff Bezos paying less a share of his wealth and income to the government to compensate us for the use of our publicly funded research, the internet, the highway system, the universities that are churning out brilliant people to go work at his company, having him pay less than the people who are scrubbing his toilets. That's a problem.
So this is interesting. I want to zoom in on the use of the word outsourced when it came to specifically the climate change example, because I don't think that's what's going on here. And this is where, by booking you, I've nuked my chances of being a WEF young global leader. So I'm going to do my bit to reclaim if
you
think
you
wants
still
to
might make it, actually.
I'm only 29. I've got 5 years to pull it off. We'll see. Look that up if anyone wants to see the Easter egg reference I made there. But here's the problem. Outsource suggests that there's been some type of discussion in the U.S. Here is this problem, climate change. We, the American people, agree there's this problem. We have these options on the table, carbon tax, cap and trade. Green New Deal is like a resolution, so it's not a specific policy, but a set of policies that would come from passing that resolution. But instead, we think that we can allow the private sector to solve that problem. But that isn't what's actually happening here. We just are not, there is just no consensus within this specific version of Congress. Now, you can say that's Joe Manchin, you can say that's Kyrsten Sinema, but given the system we have, there is no actual consensus from an implementation of policy perspective. So how do you just think about this idea of what issues are outsourced? What issues are billionaires in good faith saying we could step in to this space where nothing's getting done? How do you think about the dilemma I'm trying to put here?
I mean, first of all, I got to say, like, any policy conversation we're having right now in real time, where we're comparing, you know, one choice to another, like, oh, let's trust Larry Fink and Mark Benioff and Jamie Dimon to solve all of our problems, or let's have the government do it. Like, you lost already, right? I mean, it's like the debate over, like, can we open schools? Do teachers have, you know, enough resources, or do we have to rely on distance learning? Like, none of the above. Thank you very much. Like, if those are the choices on the menu, like, it's game over. We're in a time where Davos, man, and this is what I lay out in the book, has systematically over centuries pillaged government. I mean, let's just look at the social safety net, for instance. I mean, in Denmark, and yeah, I know it's a cliche to compare this to Denmark, but I actually think it's useful. In Denmark, a family of four where the breadwinner loses their job. 6 months later, they're living on 87% of their previous income. In the US, the same number is about 27%. That's directly a function of not taxing people like Mark Benioff and Jeff Bezos, not having a wealth tax, not even taxing under our convoluted income tax system, because we've allowed Davos Man to starve the IRS of resources. We've allowed, you know, overseas shenanigans in terms of money moving around the globe beyond reach of the tax collector. You know, we start with a government that is just mortally weakened, and then we compare it to the option of just depending upon the billionaires and their market solutions to solve our problems. This is the Davos Man playbook. First, you starve government and you make it dysfunctional. And then you say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's dysfunctional. Let's just dismantle it. And you transfer the proceeds of what used to be public spending to the billionaire class. That's not how you deal with life in general, to say nothing of a pandemic. And we've certainly learned that through the pandemic. So I, you know, if we're trying to rationalize, you know, an existing Congress, like, we got to look at this broad context. Like, all of this stuff has happened with both major political parties, the White House controlled by Republicans and Democrats alike, Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike, buying into this idea that taxes are bad, regulation's bad, and we just need to unleash the animal forces of the market. I mean, what I call the cosmic lie in this book, that if we just let money flow where it wants to, which really means where the donor class would like it to, then wealth will just magically trickle down through the economy, something that has, in fact, happened zero times. So we've got to strengthen government. And yeah, then we can have partnerships between the private sector and government. I mean, look, I'm with Larry Fink, like the world's largest asset manager, who I critique heavily in my book. This is a guy who controls $10 trillion of investment, who's a big champion of stakeholder capitalism, you know, claims that he's urging companies around the planet to take steps to get right with climate change, you know, but says, you know, I'm not actually going to pull funds from them if they don't, but I might use shareholder votes, and I'm trying to use the bully pulpit to accomplish this. And then he'll say, you know, well, we don't want to demonize the fossil fuel companies because we need their brilliant minds to be part of the solution. Hey, that's fine. I agree with that. It's just that that doesn't mean that we hand everything over to the market and to Davos Man to solve. We need rules, and we need a government that is strengthened through progressive taxation.
Yeah, it's funny. Something you do that's actually pretty refreshing for the genre you're in is you don't really spend time just dunking on the companies themselves, and not I mean the way the company operates, but just like the idea of the company. That's basically not really as much the point here. I think something I'm curious about, though, is I don't know if you followed this semi wonky debate around upper middle class Americans and how their desires actually really drive policy, because I'm thinking back to, and I'm too young to actually have been here for this, but I've like obviously read about it. If you're looking at the California tax revolts in the 70s, right, where you really have a University of California system that used to be incredibly cheap and then it's defunded over time, and the pensions, there may have been very wealthy people funding that, but that's a revolt that's led by middle class people, to upper middle class people. So as we're looking at this broad problem you're describing, right? So the gradual loss of faith in government, this, right, Ronald Reagan, if the, you know, the last thing you want to hear is the government saying we're here to help, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, starve the beast. I think you're undercounting the role that actual people, aside from just the Davos jet setting class, not through false consciousness, but just through their own actual belief systems, were played in that. What do you think about what I'm saying?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's an important point. I am not laying out this kind of puppeteer conspiracy. It's not as neat as like, yeah, a handful of billionaires, they stole all the money, let's get it back and everything's fixed at the end. Certainly. I mean, what I'm saying is that the central element in many of the events that I'm most interested in, and this book starts, you know, with Trump, Brexit, the rise of the extreme right in Italy, in France, even in Sweden, you know, the supposed bastion of social democracy, the commonality that I find on the surface, there's a reaction to the other, you know, the immigrant. China's eating our lunch. You know, we've got to attack China. It's never it's never domestic, right? Like in America, like when you go talk to steel workers who, as I did in the summer of 2016, who've never voted for a Republican in their lives, who are going to vote for Trump, they're, you know, they're just delighted that he's taken on China. Never mind that most of our problems are really made in boardrooms in New York, in Seattle, in Washington. And so we see that picture repeated in Brexit, which is this kind of nativist response to the reality that there are declining living standards for huge numbers of people in Britain and cuts to social services. And in Sweden, it's particularly extreme. You have this influx of immigrants, and this party that was actually born in the neo-Nazi movement, the Sweden Democrats, goes from the wilderness to the third most popular party in the country. And I take your point, because I think what each of these illustrates is what I say in the book is, you know, the political opportunists who can capitalize on these transformations to sell this shallow narrative of, you know, these foreigners are coming into your community and they're stealing your prosperity. But there is a lot of individual responsibility there too. And I think the commonality, I quite honestly, is integration. And it was interesting when I was in Sweden, hearing the Sweden Democrats talk about how, oh no, we still believe in collectivism. We still believe in paying some of the highest taxes on earth in exchange for generous social benefits that we all know about, you know, 500 days of parental leave when you have a baby, cradle to grave healthcare, universal education. We still believe in that. We just don't want to squander our taxes on these other people. And they were talking about, you know, Somali refugees, Syrian refugees, Afghan refugees, people, they don't speak Swedish. They pray to other gods. They're waking us up with their mosques, and they're not going to work. And if they're not going to work, then they're not going to be able to pay taxes. And then they're freeloaders. And we're still for collectivism, but not for them. And to me, it was very reminiscent of reporting I've done in the States, where, you know, I've looked at the fact that in many American cities, the one I visited that comes to mind is Chattanooga, you know, you have large numbers of unemployed African-American men living in downtowns, dying for work, and they can't get to jobs because the bus no longer goes to where the new jobs are. Like in Chattanooga, it was this Amazon warehouse on the fringes of the city. And I remember talking to this kind of old city manager who said, yeah, you know, look, as soon as there was white flight, basically you had these predominantly white families in the suburbs who were like, well, I don't need the bus. I mean, I'm driving my family around in a minivan. And to them, the public bus became this kind of like welfare system on wheels, and they had no desire to pay taxes anymore. I think that's central to understanding what happened in places like California with the property tax revolt. And it's true. We can't stick Davos Man with all the responsibilities. What I'm arguing in the book is that when Davos Man comes along and then pillages on top of all the foundational problems that we've got that are much deeper than just wealth, that creates an opportunity for somebody to tell a simplistic narrative that will play on racial stereotypes, that will cater to people's worst instincts as they fashion an explanation that then lets Davos Man off the hook for the inequality that we're dealing with.
And it's really tough to talk about those Swedish examples or UKIP in the UK, because so much of that is tied into just legit racist, insert terrible people. But I want to try to get as nuanced as possible, because the part that resonates when you see these critiques against, let's say, basically like the post-Cold War center left to center right consensus, or basically this idea that the broader governing class made a series of decisions that were either wrong or did not have proper buy-in from the society itself. So to the Sweden example, Sweden through hundreds of years had come to a consensus about what it is to be a Swede, the set of policies that apply to Swedes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. On the face of it, obviously, a starting point of a conversation isn't, well, black and brown folks, screw you, you're not blonde and pale skinned, whatever. But what was the conversation around admitting refugees into the country around? Do you see what I'm trying to basically get at? I'm trying to get to the tension between consent from the broader populace and consensus around what it is to do this, this or that with these new additions. So like with refugees, like you say in the book, there's right. part of what's driving the debate in Sweden is, well, okay, how long are you allowed to effectively not work because you don't know the language, because you didn't graduate from high school, because you don't have skill set? Like, that's there's like severe philosophical debates at hand there.
Right.
How does one balance the needs of, once again, a collapsing Middle East or Afghanistan with the need to get consensus from the governed?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think it's a lot easier to have that conversation when there isn't scarcity, right? So the political opportunists like the Sweden Democrats, who are now saying, you know, pretty blatantly racist things, while presenting these racist things as sort of matters of fiscal rectitude. You know, they'll say, if you spend enough time with them, they'll talk about, well, we're kind of uncomfortable, you know, seeing these people who don't look like us on the streets of our towns. And I kept hearing from people, oh, these mosques are blaring in the morning, and that's a real nuisance for people. But no, but we're really just saying, you know, it's about, we can't afford these things. Well, why can't you afford these things? Because way back, 30 years before a big surge of migrants came in 2015, you allowed wealth taxes to be essentially obliterated in the interest of not allowing the next, you know, Ingvar Kamprad, the founder of IKEA, to run off and put his money in a tax haven like Switzerland. So it's very difficult to then have a productive conversation with the public about what should be a very reasonable goal. I mean, the truth is, same as in the U.S. for that matter, you know, immigration is a net plus for the economy. I mean, some people will be affected at the lower skilled end of the equation in terms of competition for their wages, but it's a net plus in terms of wealth building to allow hardworking people who are eager to start new lives in a society to gain skills, start businesses, pay taxes, you know, all that stuff. The problem is, and Sweden, by the way, saw immigration in those terms. I mean, the town in which I based my reporting in Sweden, this town of Filipstad, a couple of hours to the west of Stockholm, you know, they it's a classic case of manufacturing declined, and the town was hollowed out, the timber operations failed, people were moving out, and it wasn't clear who was going to take care of the senior citizens, how was the tax base going to be built, there was all this empty housing, so it made sense to move these immigrants in. And the government really failed in terms of fashioning a coherent explanation. They, you know, what they should have said again and again is, our model's going to work. Like, yeah, it's true. The first generation, I mean, after you strip away the doctors who came in from Syria who are very easily employed, you teach them Swedish, they can be doctors, you're done. It's true that somebody who has a high school education, who doesn't speak Swedish and doesn't have any particular skills, they're going to need a lot of the public's largesse, maybe for an entire generation. Their kids are going to be born in Sweden. They're going to speak Swedish. They're going to have skills. They're going to be hardworking. In fact, in most societies, we see the immigrants are harder working than the native born. I mean, that's just the reality. They have drive that the native born tend not to have. So this will be a net plus. But they didn't say that. They cast it in these kind of humanitarian terms, which then invites the public to view this as almost like, you know, a positive kind of colonialist mentality. Oh, we're going to welcome these people and we're the superheroes of doing good. It was like an act of charity as opposed to an investment in a model that probably would have worked just fine. And that set up the equation for the Sweden Democrats to come in and essentially peddle racism as a kind of fiscal rectitude.
You know, I'm really happy you framed your response to my pushback along those lines, because two things. So one, just this idea of zero sum societies not being effective places to form consensus, it fits into the story we're telling, because insert obvious statement, we're talking about pre-civil rights America when we're talking about 1945 to 1965. Insert statement, the white picket fence wasn't everybody, but at a broad economic level, post-World War II America was an America where the economic pie was expanding, where you did have manufacturing, where you did have cradle-to-grave pensions if you're working at an automobile factory. That was a society that could form a consensus. So it's hard to say here right now, well, why can't we find a consensus when, as you're describing here in the book, you have this society that's been rotted out at that level. So I guess let's just get into that part. What what should we do? Because here's my problem. This is where we're actually getting to. Taxing Elon Musk's wealth or taxing Jeff Bezos more wouldn't get at the structural rot that's set in. Like you said, this is a story that takes place over hundreds of years. So I think that's the part that always feels, and it's kind of funny. Like when Elon Musk like fights with Elizabeth Warren on Twitter over this, he usually ends up winning the debate because right. He basically says, dude, you just spent X trillions of dollars on economic stimulus. You taking my $5 billion isn't going to do anything. Now there's the equality argument, which is one argument for taxation, but at a practical economic level, he's kind of correct. So how do you, or at least from my perspective, he's kind of correct. So how do you think about that?
I think you got to think big picture. I mean, you got to go back to the fact that from 1945 till 1975 in the United States, we had a system that passed a commensurate share of the economic gains, you know, productivity increases to get wonky, got transferred to workers through wages. And they got their piece of the action. And so, you know, I don't want a time machine back to 1975, right? I think we've made a lot of progress that we want to hang on to. We had the Vietnam War. We had Jim Crow in that era. Like, let's get real. But we need to get back to that. The fact that the cliche, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, that actually happened in that time. And people could count on, you know, if I set my alarm clock and I go to work and I stay out of trouble and I try to further my kids' education and I make some intelligent decisions, like I'm going to be more than all right. Like I'm going to be better than my parents and my children will be in a position to really prosper. That was true for just about every community in the United States. We shouldn't be happy with the extent of progress. There were huge gaps. There were all kinds of injustices. But everybody was getting their piece of the action. And now we're in a situation where most people aren't. And most people have concluded, quite legitimately, even people who are wealthy on paper, that their needs, their desire to have a life at even a middle-class standard, to keep the lights on, to pay their bills, just doesn't matter that much to the people who are running the economy. And that's got to be fixed. There's lots of ways to fix that. We can talk about that in terms of the nitty-gritty. But if you don't fix that, then everything else is meaningless because you can't have a conversation about, you know, anything. I mean, take climate change, right? It's our existential crisis. Take Joe Manchin, who speaks in the name of, you know, protecting coal miners from extinction. Coal miners have to go extinct, right? Coal, if you're looking at it in any credible way, should be part of the past, not part of the future. We had a lot of people who pay their bills with coal mining. What do we say to the coal miner when we ask them to sacrifice and trust us that there'll be something better for you down the line if we invested this bountiful future, we make the transition? How is that person, through their lived experience, going to get any assurance that anyone will help them? Who's going to pay for them to be trained to go install solar panels or whatever, or move to the Sun Belt where life is supposedly thriving? Where is all this support? And you can't have a social safety net, by the way, that could help a person like that without serious changes in the tax code. But more broadly, unless that person and lots of other people have a feeling of, you know, there is a society that I have a stake in, and if I stumble, you know, somebody will help me out, then it's impossible to address any of our problems. I often come back to this experience I had. You know, I just picked on Sweden as an example of, you know, a society that's catered to Davos man and has hurt its social safety net. It's still awfully robust in any sort of global context. And I went to this Swedish mining operation back in, I think, 2017, where I visited these people working at this mine about to automate. They were going to bring in self-driving trucks. And I talked to all the rank and file, and every single one of them said, yeah, we're fine with that. We're fine. You know, if the robots are going to make the company more competitive, that that's going to make the company more profitable. And if my job goes away, they'll train me for some other job and our wages will go up. And that wasn't some like Nordic fantasy they were buying into. That was reflective of their experience, where labor unions represent 70% of the workforce. They sit down opposite employers association representatives every year. They hash out pay scales in which the productivity gains must flow to the workers commensurate with those gains. So these guys had faith. So they could have a conversation about automation. And by the way, you know, contrary to way we in the States, I think, tend to write off the Nordics and Europe in general, as that's like nanny state socialism. They're much more entrepreneurial. All the whole Schumpeter creative destruction thing, it's a lot easier to do if, you know, you can start a company and it fails, but you don't end up sleeping under a bridge when you lose your job, when you can count on healthcare the whole way through. And that's something that comes through progressive taxation and strengthened labor unions. Those are the things, that plus enforcement of antitrust, that are really the keys to reviving more opportunities for ordinary people in the States.
See, it's interesting because the example you gave of busing in Chattanooga is really important, because with state and local government, there's no such thing as deficit spending. So there really is, you know, often you have budget balance, budget amendments in the state. So there is this actually very serious limit. But on a national scale, once again, this is something I work at a tech company, so I spend a lot of time with younger tech people in the tech industry who feel this way. They look at what you just said and said, Peter, we literally just spent trillions of dollars. It goes towards the deficit. The notion that we're not spending money on healthcare or social safety net expansion or retraining programs because Jeff Bezos isn't paying his taxes just isn't true. Like, it's kind of like a funny perversion of Stephanie Kelton's argument, if you think about it, which is, you know, essentially obviously that, you know, taxation matters as a, you know, tamp down on income inequality, but, you know, we can spend money. So I guess I'm just objecting to the notion. Let me just put it this way. I think there's this weird double-edged sword when you argue that increasing taxes, which is always going to be unpopular at a governmental level, especially given the fact that a huge portion of the Democratic Party's base is in that upper middle class to middle class boundary, who's very, very skeptical of taxation. Right. It seems like you're setting yourself up for trouble. Versus, I would much rather just say, hey, look, we should pass paid sick leave. And if we pay for it, how we pay for it.
We should do that too.
So I'm asking you this at a political level, the question there.
Well, I mean, the political level, there's a question of messaging in a time when we've, you know, essentially absorbed the Davos man notion that everything's binary, right? Like, we either have the status quo and Jeff Bezos gets to keep all of his money, and we get COVID vaccines where Pfizer gets to sell them to the highest bidder around the world. And the result is we have variants because we got frontline medical workers in parts of Africa and South Asia who don't have any protection while we're, you know, giving boosters to kids in the U.S. We either have that, we accept that that's just how it is, or we have no vaccines at all. We don't have Uber. We don't have Tesla. We don't have any kind of healthcare. We might as well be Venezuela, like diving into dumpsters for our dinner. And we've accepted that binary. And so every conversation about being able to afford anything, you know, is framed in that way. And that's, as a result of that, we always have money for more tax cuts for billionaires, because that's about win-win solutions and trickle down and innovation. And we don't have money for paid sick leave. We don't have money for childcare. We don't have money for these child tax credits because deficit fear mongering. Well, I would push back though on this idea that, like, well, we've spent all this money. Yeah, we've spent all this money in an emergency, but it's as if, like, for decades, we've said, well, we're not going to put insulation in our house. We're not going to upgrade the plumbing. We're not going to deal with the fact that the roof hasn't been addressed in decades. And then when there's a hell of a storm and, like, Katrina comes, yeah, we're going to send in the Coast Guard to rescue people. And, you know, we're going to drop bags of money. And most of it's actually going to go to wealthy people because, you know, let's face it, like, these rescue programs that we've had, I mean, the $1.9 trillion under Biden, hugely helpful in terms of the extended unemployment benefits. Trump's rescue, also helpful compared to the relief that we saw during the Great Recession with expanded unemployment benefits and various supports for real people. But the bulk of the money, bolster the asset class. And the asset class, that's Davos, man. That's why, you know, the billionaires literally doubled their wealth in the last 2 years during the pandemic, while Oxfam tells us 99% of humanity actually saw their wealth damaged. I mean, that is a reflection of the system that we've lived in. So to say that we've spent all this money is misleading. I mean, we need a house, to come back to the metaphor, that is built to withstand not only crises, but like everyday problems. And we don't have that. And we shouldn't claim that because there are labor shortages now and, you know, trucking companies have to hand out $15,000 bonuses to get truck drivers, and medical systems are killing one another to attract nurses because they've run out of that this is somehow like a change in the basic power structure. This is all discretionary. This is Davos Man's playbook. Like, well, if we have to pay now, we'll do it on our terms. We're not engaged in collective bargaining. We're not actually changing pay scales in some way in which workers can take to the bank. You know, my colleague, Noam Scheiber at the Times, just dropped this really important story about how part-time work is still very much with us. So the employer class, they'll pay more in wages, they'll pay bonuses, but they're not giving up the flexibility they need through essentially the gig economy, through flexible hours, and that allows them to avoid paying benefits. I mean, the power structure is the same, and that's something that most people know in their bones. They know that they're living in a society where their needs just don't matter that much to the powers that be. And I really think, like, from that, we can get to an understanding of January 6th, low vaccination rates in the states. It's not that I'm justifying the often racist and insane ideas that people will embrace and actually turn into action. On the contrary, I'm not. But I am saying that if you leave huge numbers of people kind of marinated in scarcity and the knowledge that they don't matter very much in the power structure, they're going to be vulnerable to some crazy ideas, to conspiracy theories. And those ideas are going to be poisonous, and they're going to prevent us from reckoning with our problems.
Yeah. So a couple quick questions as we get close to wrapping here. Just quick note, I appreciate from a podcast host accountability perspective, your point around comparing a one-time emergency governmental intervention to 40 years of history isn't a particularly useful. It's not as useful as I guess I thought it was as I was putting on the question. That's very well taken. But here's a broader question to ask here. It seems to me the big debate, if I'm imagining Mark Benioff being here right now, is how much. Actually, let me put it this way. My critique of the Davos class after reading your book would be the following, which is that the reason why words like humanity first capitalism and fourth industrial revolution, globalization, the world is flat, Thomas Friedman fits into this category. The reason why it's dangerous is that it describes very specific policy choices as inevitable. So it says, hey, the world is flat, to the China trade shock example. The world's flat. I'm not personally blaming Thomas Friedman for this one, but it's easy to say, hey, look, the world is flat now. We have to let China into the WTO, and that's how it's going to go. It serves as a shortcut for thinking here. So my question for you is, how do you, as a person who's writing about these economic issues, how do we differentiate between things that are actually different now versus policy choices? Because I think a good example of something, speaking to your industry with the New York Times, something that actually is different is the internet has made it that the New York Times no longer has a geographic monopoly on a specific region. That means if you're a local newspaper, you used to be able to compete with the New York Times, because if you're in some corner of Oregon where I'm from, that's the paper. But now the local Podunk Times has to compete with the New York Times, charging similar prices, and that causes a huge problem. Like, that is not a policy choice. That is a result of something actually changing. How do we differentiate between the example I just gave and the very discreet, this happens to benefit the Davos class, and it actually right. isn't inevitable stuff?
I think that's a super important question that doesn't have a simple answer, and I won't pretend to come up with one, but I'll say this. You know, my overriding mission in writing this book is to expose how Davos Man time and again will tell us that every problem is too complicated. to be solved, which is an elaborate justification for the status quo. And the answer, to come full circle on our conversation, is, you know, multi-stakeholder dialogues, right? It's always like more talk amongst the earnest people who, by engaging in the talk, are proving their goodness and integrity. That's the solution. And so, you know, you just, as Greta Thunberg put it, you just get 30 years of blah, 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 and you know, nothing changes. I do think that you can acknowledge that there is complexity, and your example is a good one. Yes, globalization is complicated. Yes, global flows of money are so complex that they're beyond any single jurisdiction to sort out, and labor arbitrage, you know, the same, right? I mean, the AFL-CIO can't just organize for better wages in the U.S., and never mind that they control a very small part of the workforce, and then somehow, you know, deal with the reality that their rank and file people are now competing with people in Mexico and China and Bangladesh and wherever. That's all baked in. But I think that we must take care that while we acknowledge that, we not fall for Davos Man's essential justification for the status quo by telling us that because these things are complex, there's nothing that we can do to alter the structure of our societies. And, you know, let's take Bezos, right? I spent a lot of time on Bezos in the book. Bezos is an especially complicated case because the guy's a genius, right? I mean, he revolutionized e-commerce. He had a great idea. It's hard to imagine how we would have gotten through the pandemic without e-commerce. And probably the most important person in the history of e-commerce is Jeff Bezos. So he would argue, you know, he earned his money, and let's just leave it at that. We can acknowledge Bezos's contributions and affirm a system in which Jeff Bezos is going to own a whole lot more houses than most of us, and maybe even blast himself into space, and still say, we can demand that the people working in his warehouses left on Earth have PPE while they're in the first wave of the pandemic. And if they don't have PPE, then the warehouse can't be open. And then they get paid sick leave, something that Amazon, you know, not by accident, doesn't have to pay because it's lobbied aggressively for that state of play. We can demand that there be progressive taxation. We can demand that the antitrust authorities take a look at Amazon and how it's snuffed out all sorts of other competitors, and how it seems to have used the pandemic, while it's very Davos Man style, telling us that it's, you know, saving our grandmothers by, you know, sorry for Christian Smalls, the organizer of the labor movement in Staten Island, who was fired for staging a walkout in response to unsafe conditions at the warehouse. But, you know, they're saving everybody else by keeping the PPE going. Well, in fact, they seem to have actually slowed down the delivery of a lot of vital things while prioritizing the monopolization of the logistics space, so that if you weren't selling on Prime, you went to the back of the queue. And the result of that was we actually saw a slowdown in people receiving things like face masks and hand sanitizer and the other stuff that we're supposed to thank Amazon for delivering. We can acknowledge the complexity and still pull what levers we've got. I mean, the U.S. is, by any accounting, the biggest beneficiary of globalization on Earth. And it's also true that we have large numbers of people who have suffered the kind of globalization that we've experienced because we haven't had help and training for people whose jobs have essentially been sent somewhere else. And we haven't spread equitably the gains of our very successful form of capitalism. We can keep all the good stuff and get back to a much more fair system.
And here's the final question that, to the way I started the conversation, resonates with me. I was in high school during the 2008 financial crisis, and I was politically active and engaged. So I remember all of the 2009, it's right after the financial crisis, all of these very Davosian, never again, insert reset opportunities, insert consciousness. It feels as if we are going to get stuck in this every 5 to 10 years. There's just going to be another version of we need to have the conversation, to your Mark Benioff example. And look, we've got a politically diverse audience, so some people will agree with what you said, some people will disagree. But I think something we can all agree on is that status quo continues. We're just constantly having these very like you and I both know exactly what the 2029 Davos Forum will look like. It will be some jumble mix up of like stakeholders, winners, losers. Donald Trump Jr. may have won, and maybe we have to talk about that in some form or fashion, whatever. How do we just stop having this conversation, to your Greta Thunberg example, and actually just transition to something useful?
We stop looking to the beneficiaries of the system as the change agents. We stop falling for this idea that, well, now it's stakeholder capitalism. I don't know what it'll be in 2029, but it'll be something that will
be very wealthy. If you knew, if you could predict the blobby branding, man, that'd be a marketing agency if there ever was one.
Totally. Yeah. Look, I remember going to Davos. I think it was in 2017. It was in the middle of all this public outrage over profiteering by pharmaceutical companies. And there was this gathering of pharmaceutical company executives, like the biggest winners, like Gilead was there, you know? And there was this earnest moderator from CNBC going around the room. So, you know, what do you all think the solution is? You know, why are drug prices so unaffordable? And it was all like, well, I don't know, maybe we haven't come up with the right model. We need a stakeholder dialogue around proper modes of governance, and we need some kind of public-private partnership. You know, these guys knew absolutely, right? I mean, in Davos, I've seen pharmaceutical executives get up in the morning and go have meditation sessions with Jon Kabat-Zinn, and then they go off to their private suites where Klaus Schwab sets them up so they can forge the next merger engineered to lift drug prices. I mean, the people in the room are hiding under this mantra committed to improving the state of the world. They're committed to improving the state of their bottom lines. And the point of my book is not to say, oh, hypocrisy, we need to replace them with people who are actually good. No, we need to excise this idea that the CEO class, the billionaire class, Davos man, is going to come up with the solution to our problems. The solution to our problems exists in our own democratic mode of governance. You know, we fought these battles before. This is not like some sort of exotic utopian conversation. The robber barons upset enough people and made American life untenable for so many that the result of that was antitrust enforcement, progressive taxation after the Great Depression, the New Deal with social safety nets. And for 30 years afterwards, the economy functioned fairly well for most people. We know what to do. The problem is that doing it involves taking on the people who are the beneficiaries of the system we've got. And that is a pretty big problem if you think about it.
Yeah, very well said. Peter, actually, if you have 1 second, I do have one big question here.
Sure.
And this just came to mind. Something I was just struggling with while reading the book and thinking of Mark Benioff. And so let's put aside the financial Davos men, because I frankly find them a lot less impressive than the tech Davos men in terms of, I'm sorry, financial chicanery is not the same thing as Jeff Bezos gaming out what Amazon could be, driving across the country and then doing that. It's just not right. Separate the consequences of how that decision was implemented. Like, that is genius. I don't laud
it's genius a movie.
Stuff in it. Yeah, I just don't laud it the same way. Steve Jobs is different than Larry Fink on 15 different levels.
Sure.
So the thing is, when you're looking at the tech billionaires, they have real, tangible, serious accomplishments. And a dynamic that you have happen in a society where things are zero sum, there's hyperpolarization, government doesn't really have any big W's it could put on the board. FDR, if you're talking about, you know, the robber barons, or, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, like, I charged up San Juan Hill. Politicians today actually basically don't have any wins. And even when you're someone like President Obama, you pass Obamacare and that then becomes super controversial for the next 8 years. So how does a political class that's unable to just win, unable to build the Hoover Dam, unable to go to the moon, unable to build the highway system, unable to win World War II, how can it possibly? And I think this partially explains part of the problem. I don't see how it could possibly, at a rhetorical political performance level, given this lack of credibility, compete with the Jeff Bezoses and the Elon Musks of the world. I think so much of Elon Musk's is successful, at least once again, Twitter fighting Elizabeth Warren energy to at least a standstill in terms of public discourse comes from the fact that he could say, I built SpaceX, I built Tesla, I was there at PayPal at the ground floor, what have you done? And people, it's actually really fascinating to see just the young people who tend to be very distasteful billionaires, very skeptical of big institutions, love that energy from Elon. So I'm just curious how you, because this just, I was thinking that perpetually as I was reading the book.
I think that's a great point. I mean, look, the average person, like, what team do you want to be on? Right. I mean, do you want to be on, you know, the Apple guys with their sleek campus and their wonderful meals and their genius, you know, brainstorming sessions where they've produced things that we all really like that have revolutionized our life? No question, these are achievements. Or do you want to go hang out with people in the halls of Congress? Right. Most people don't have to think about that for a millisecond. Right.
Yeah.
Who's cooler in that equation? But, you know, that's a little bit like if you're in a union. Well, do I want to be in the rank and file with, you know, every union includes like, well, that, you know, the crazy guy. Oh, the, you know, the woman who's just always filing a grievance over some minute thing who's trying to monkey wrench progress. You know, do I want to be on that team? Where's management? I mean, they've got cool PowerPoint presentations and, you know, they're flying off to fantastic destinations. I'd rather be on that. Well, guess what? That team, the management team, is able to fly off to those exotic destinations because of their effective exploitation of the people on your team. That's your team, whether you like it or not. We're stuck with Congress. It's not that we need to embrace government as the solution to all of our problems. It's not that we want big state solutions, picking the winners, setting prices. Look, I'm a capitalist. I want Elon Musk and Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos to have a significant seat at the table in terms of, you know, dreaming up these visions that have revolutionized our lives. I just want the public to have some say over how the gains get apportioned so that we're not living in a society where we're supposed to just ingest the kind of pixie dust, like the aura of being around all this success while most people are just, you know, barely keeping the lights on. That is not a tenable situation. So I think, you know, the solution to being led by opportunistic demagogues isn't to go find some other demagogues, right? It's to gradually put in place policies that we know will win while having a conversation about restoring more opportunity to more people. And let's face it, like most of the things we would get out of progressive taxation are things that actually poll well. People want more healthcare. They want more affordable housing. People want better infrastructure. I mean, most Americans who go anywhere else on earth that has money or even developing countries come back just astonished by how appalling our infrastructure is. So it's about organizing around the things that people actually want and then coming up with the solutions to deliver those things. And then it's pretty simple, but it still involves taking on, you know, active misinformation. I mean, one of the most innovative parts of these, you know, tech geniuses we're talking about. I mean, let's look at how Amazon protects itself from the knowledge of the mistreatment of its warehouse workers. They actually, I mean, this is something that robber barons would have just like lusted for. The social media, right? The digital realm, right? Amazon actually commissions the production of fake television spots with, you know, interviews with happy Amazon workers, data points about protection of Amazon workers. And they disseminate these through local television stations across the United States that are so strapped for resources and needing content that they air these segments as if it's news. I mean, that's, you got to admire like the genius of that, the digital capacity, and you got to see that that's not about the public interest.
Man, I'm not going to title the episode this, but a theme that's come through with what you're saying here is that choosing between these binaries is actively destructive. And even the way I set up that question,
right?
American people, pick Elon Musk or like a Harvard law professor senator. That right. Actually is incredibly unproductive. And what we should strive to do, and this is really my takeaway from this conversation, so I appreciate it, is pushing away from the binaries, because that actually in of itself, it's not just a false choice, but it's not even a useful construct for thinking through the problem set. So, Peter, thank you so much. This was really great. And
this was a fantastic conversation.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. No, I really enjoyed your questions. Yeah.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.